For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show we take a deep dive into the Alias Emma series by Eva Glass. Out now is book two in the Alias Emma series, The Tracer by Eva Glass. Nothing about Emma Makepeace is real, not even her name. Alias Emma Book 1, The Chase, is a brace-neck, race-against-the-clock thriller in which a British spy has 12 hours to deliver her asset across London after Russia hacks the city's security cameras. Can she make it without being spotted or killed? And in the brand new Book 2, The Traitor, when an MI6 operative is murdered in his London apartment, fellow spy Emma Makepeace knows the killer was professional. She also knows that no one is safe until the third man is caught, and that she's in terrifying danger. I'll talk to author Eva Glass and find out about her background that inspired the Alias Emma series. But for now, let's hear a clip from the brand new book, The Traitor. Both books are narrated by Sophie Colquhoun.
Emma's phone rang, interrupting her thoughts. The number on the screen was the agency's emergency line. She answered quickly. Makepeace? I've a message from R. Are you in a safe place? It was a woman's voice, as emotionless as a machine. Frowning, Emma stepped out of the flow of pedestrians. Yes, continue. This is the message. You're off the Gorodin case. I need you elsewhere. An address will be sent. Go to it immediately. The woman's flat monotone paused. The message ends. Do you need me to repeat? No, I've got it, Emma said. The line went dead and a text appeared on her secure screen. 75 Thames Mansions, flat 652, W6. Emma's heart began to race. The Gorodin project was just getting underway. If the agency wanted her off it already, something big must have happened. Dropping the phone into her pocket, she began to run.
Emma Makepeace is a young British intelligence officer. She's in her late 20s. She's been with an agency that is so secret it doesn't have a name. It sits somewhere between MI5 and MI6, and its sole focus is on Russian spies operating inside the UK. So when we meet her, she's still in training, so she's only been given the smaller undercover projects. But as the book begins, she's given her first big job, which is to find the son of two former Russian spies who are now in hiding in the UK. He's a grown man, but he knows very little about his parents' background. And the Russian government has targeted him for assassination as revenge against his parents. They're going for him now, and she's got to convince him this is true, first of all, and then get him to safety. That's basically the entire plot of The Chase, is that she's got to do that, and she's got to do it quickly. I lived in London for 8 years, and I was always and still am fascinated by nocturnal life in any big city. So there is something about a big, sprawling metropolitan area when everyone's asleep. I find that time just sort of like lawless, a bit dangerous, and really quite fascinating, because it's so different from daytime in the city, when those streets that are normally packed with buses and taxi cabs and commuters are suddenly empty and quiet, and there's just sort of predators and possible victims on the sidewalks.
The sun was setting over one of the most expensive streets in the world when the assassins arrived. The CCTV camera on the central London corner recorded long blades of golden light stretched out across limestone walls as two men walked down the exclusive avenue. As if invisible, they passed unnoticed by a nanny pushing a buggy, and a trio of well-exercised women, thin as wraiths, chattering as they ambled to the gym. It was a bright autumn day, but the men kept their heads tilted down so no camera recorded their features as they slipped out of the shadows and approached a six-story building where the last apartment sold went for £14 million. The camera above the door captured one of them standing guard, his face turned away, while the other bent over the handle. After a few seconds, the door opened. In another city, there might have been a doorman or a security guard, but residents in this neighbourhood never liked to be observed going about their business. The most prized buildings had long been the kind where you can walk from the front door to your flat without seeing a soul. This was one of those. Bypassing the Art Deco cage elevator with its modern security camera, the men climbed the red-carpeted stairs without being challenged, all the way to the top floor. Outside, Knightsbridge went about its elegant business. A scarlet Lamborghini rumbled by with a panther's purr, pausing at a red light. A delivery truck idled behind it, the driver leaning his elbow against the open window, ogling the car's voluptuous lines. The three women reached the corner and waited for the signal to cross. The noise of the traffic passing on the cross street must have hidden the sounds of the struggle from the building behind them, because no one looked up as a body plummeted from the window of the top floor apartment.
Now, you'll be taking Emma out of her comfort zone in the next book, The Trader, but first of all, is Emma based on anyone in real life?
That's such a good question. My background is that I was a journalist for years, and then for 5 years, I took a job working for the British government in a role that brought me in close contact with intelligence officers, so basically with spies. And the first spy I ever met was a young woman who completely fooled me. She sort of, when I first started there, she befriended me. I kept running into her in places that I regularly went to. So in the coffee shop I went to every morning, in the sandwich shop down the street. She said she worked in the legal department and we sort of became friends, and she asked a lot of questions about my past. And then after a few weeks, she absolutely disappeared. And after that, I began getting the more serious sort of work coming into my desk. And it took me a long time to realize that she was part of my background check. She was a spy. And I've been really fascinated by her ever since, because she was so young. She was so confident and so convincing. And I wanted to explore in this book, you know, what that's like, how that could happen, how somebody in their 20s could be that good at deception.
When you worked between MI5 and MI6, could you tell who were the spies and who were the civil servants?
Not unless they wanted you to know. One of the key things that I learned about intelligence work is that the whole James Bond, Jason Bourne mythology of the sort of beautiful spy and the amazing clothes with the rippling muscles is simply not in touch with reality, because in reality, what a spy has to do is fit in. And the best attribute a spy can have is to look normal, is to just look like us. And they do. And nobody ever introduced themselves to me ever in all the years I was there as a spy or as an intelligence officer. They would, in fact, everybody had a cover name and a cover job title. And so they would be Bob from logistics, only there was no logistics, and it was, his name almost certainly wasn't Bob. And it would often take me a long time to kind of figure it out. But also everybody in my office, we were always guessing who was and who wasn't, and guessing very carefully, because you never knew if the person sitting next to you might also be in that world.
Now, your job was a communications consultant, which basically is getting spies to talk about themselves, which I guess is the last thing they want to do.
Yeah, that was quite a challenge. So basically, I was brought in by the Home Secretary as part of a new initiative of what they like to call outreach. So basically, getting direct communication to the public, explaining to people what everybody does. And everybody was at various levels of government was meant to be doing this, to sort of sort of demystify, I guess, the world of government. And in most cases, this was uncontroversial, but for spies, it was appalling. They hated it. They absolutely hated it. And we would have these long meetings where I would explain Facebook or Twitter and tell them that they should use social media to directly communicate. And they would just be horrified by the idea. And it was just a clash of cultures. And I think that for me, while it was frustrating, they did sort of crack the door a bit between our world and their world, just enough for me to see why they were so reticent and why they kept saying no to everything. And that was sort of, I mean, many years have passed, more than 8 years have passed since I left government, that I thought that sort of stayed in my head, I think, and resulted in me writing The Chase and then The Traitor.
Did you yourself have quite a high security clearance?
Yes, there are, I mean, there were then, because it does change, but there were then about 7 levels of security clearance, from the lowest, which would be somebody who never is going to encounter secure information, and then gradually up to the very top, which is top secret, which would be senior civil servants, intelligence operatives, and government ministers. And normally for anyone who works closely with spies, they would want top secret, but because I'm an immigrant, I grew up in the US, that would be really hard. It could take years. And so they did what's one level down from that for me. And then I think that's why I believe there was the added security check of the friend that wasn't a friend.
Emma Makepeace was born to be a spy. It was in her blood. In the chaotic years after the fall of the Soviet Union, her father had been a spy for Britain, sharing information he believed might prevent a nuclear war. But he'd been found out, and Russia had no patience for traitors. Emma had still been in the womb when her mother fled Russia, forced to leave her husband behind in order to save herself and her unborn child. Emma had been only months old when 2 British intelligence officers came to their house in the south of England to tell her mother that her father had been summarily executed before he could get out of Russia. Russia never forgives or forgets, and neither did Emma.
Now, I know you've signed the Official Secrets Act, but the spies, they did things like actually blowing up factories.
Well, basically, there's always training going on somewhere in the country for things that could happen, the worst possible scenarios. They have to prepare. And there's classroom training, which will take you so far. But the best training is on the job. And what you don't want is the people who are there to protect us learning in the aftermath of an attack how to deal with it. So they regularly go, not just usually into the countryside. The ones I went to were often in Wales, where they would do this. And they have these huge training exercises that they call games. And for that, they will basically conduct some sort of attack. They'll blow something up. They'll release something into the atmosphere that is standing in for a chemical. And then everybody on the ground, and there will be hundreds, even thousands of people involved in these games, has to react as they would in real life. It takes place over sometimes 72 hours, sometimes longer. Yeah, it's completely fascinating to see.
Just while you mentioned chemicals there, it's reminded me of something I read about you in your past career as a journalist. Before the government, you were a journalist in Georgia, and you reported on something called chemical racism.
So before I went to work for the government, I worked for a decade as a journalist, and I was a crime reporter at first for 5 years. And then after that, I became a freelance writer, and I wrote for Reuters and the New York Times and the Dallas Morning News. I was based in various American cities during that time. And when I was actually in New Orleans, I was based in New Orleans for the last few years I was in the US. I wrote a series of investigative pieces for a number of of newspapers about chemical racism, which is when chemical companies, with the tacit agreement of government, build the most toxic chemical plants in communities that are primarily Black or minority ethnic, Native American in this particular case that I wrote about, because the sense is that these people have they have the least voice. They'll be listened to the least. And so that then you have cancer rates that are disproportionate, and they affect these people more than they do perhaps communities further upriver, for example, that might be mostly white. So this was a very big issue in that area, and quite a shocking one. The cancer rates in some of these communities were sky high, even among children, and it was quite shocking. So yeah, that became a big area for me, because it was such a powerful issue to explore.
One other story that caught my eye about your past life as the reporter was a story that happened while you were covering a funeral. It says, you covered a funeral, the dead body knocked in the coffin and asked to be let out.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. Yes, okay, so that's a slight... Here's what really happened. So back when I was a crime reporter, I actually worked very closely with police, street officers, the ones that are actually doing the job. And I worked nights. And one night, one of my most generous police contacts called me and said that he had a story, because he had been assigned to go to a dead body, basically in a house, a person had died of what appeared to be natural causes. And whenever someone dies at home, they would send a police officer with, just to make sure that there was nothing suspicious before the body was taken away. And he said it was, you know, it looked perfectly normal. The person had been ill. And so the coroner came and removed the body in a body bag and took it to the morgue. And he was upstairs filling out his paperwork when the young coroner's assistant, an hour later, came flying up the stairs, absolutely white as a sheet, and said the body in the body bag had just sat up and started talking to him. And he said it had scared him so badly that he just fled the room without waiting to see what had happened. And so they all went back down, and the person was not dead, and it seemed to have been in some very deep coma, so deep that breathing had not been detected. That was genuinely the weirdest story I think I ever covered as a reporter.
There's no way to teach someone not to be afraid. Fear is an intrinsic part of us. But there are ways to make people forget their fear. Soldiers are taught to think of their enemy as something other than human. Spies are taught to think of their enemy as a traitor. This training had been particularly effective in Emma's case, because even before she joined the agency, she already despised traitors. Her father had been betrayed by someone in Russia he trusted, and that betrayal had led to his execution. To Emma, there was no sin worse than betrayal.
Well, you've taken all this experience, both working with MI5 and MI6, and being a crime reporter and a freelance journalist. You've channeled all this into your Ava Glass books, the second of which, The Traitor, as I said, came out yesterday. Tell us about The Traitor.
I loved writing this book because it was such an adventure. So in it, it was inspired by something that happened in real life about a decade ago, when a young MI6 analyst was found dead in his apartment in London, and his body was inside a suitcase that was padlocked from the outside, and the police decided it was suicide. And I think anybody who was around then and read that story, and I was, became sort of fascinated by it. I'll mention it to people and they'll just say, oh my God, I've been obsessed with that story for a decade. You know, what really happened? And so in The Traitor, I take a look at what might have actually happened, because I believe we'll never know the truth. But I wanted to sort of take a look at what could have occurred. And so I start with the murder of a young MI6 analyst in very similar circumstances in a suitcase. And so this is seen as a statement, kind of assassination, by the UK intelligence officers. So Emma Makepeace, my recurring character, is assigned to find out what happened And the trail takes her to a pair of Russian oligarchs who'd been working together in London and were suspected of selling illegal weapons. But they more or less live on their yachts. And so the only way to get close to them is to go undercover on a super yacht owned by one of these oligarchs. And so that Emma is sent to do this job, which takes her into the Mediterranean to Barcelona and Saint-Tropez. But at the entire time, she's trapped. I mean, as long as she's on a yacht, there's no backup. She's alone with somebody who's capable of the most horrific murder. And she's just got to find the evidence to bring these guys in.
Did you become quite obsessed with billionaire super yachts?
Gosh, yes. It's amazing how much information there is out there. And once, like, because I wanted to know how much is too much when it comes to a super yacht. I wanted to make sure that my yacht was realistic in terms of what is actually out there floating on the water. And what I found through reading various specialist papers and there's websites by yacht manufacturers is nothing is too much. There is no such thing as too much. Glass elevators on a yacht, absolutely. You know, multiple helipads, certainly. Six swimming pools, that all happens. It's the most amazing, bizarre world. I loved falling down that research well.
Now, was it important to take Emma away from her comfort zone of London and put her in Saint-Tropez?
Yes, I really feel like, I mean, I love writing her in London because she and the city seem, in my mind, to be so connected. But taking her out of that, and also she hates boats, so I love putting her on boats. There's one in the Chase, and then I put her on another in the Traitor because I know she hates them. But yeah, it felt really good to destabilize her in that way. And also in the third Emma Makepeace book, which I'm currently writing, it's set in Edinburgh. And so she's in Scotland, which she is not a place she's familiar with. And I'm having a huge amount of fun with her frustration at not just knowing her way around because she has such a great memory. But the Edinburgh streets are so twisty-turny that even with this remarkable memory of hers, it's impossible to quickly memorize a map of a city like that. So I'm having a blast tangling her up in these various locations that feel unfamiliar to her.
Have you done some research trips up Edinburgh?
Yes, I have. And I'm going to do another one very soon, actually, because now that before it was pre-writing research and now I'm writing it, I need to get my feet on the ground again. And I also have friends who live up there who are very helpful if I get myself in any sort of a tangle. So yeah, and who wouldn't want an excuse to go up to Edinburgh and wander around that amazing place?
Now, The Traitor, as is The Chase, are narrated by Sophie Colquhoun. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
I did, yes. My publishers sent me several choices, and I actually recommended Sophie myself. I knew her work because she had done some work on a project my husband worked on. He's a film director and TV director named Jack Jewers, and I knew she was an excellent actress and had a good reading voice as well, just a pleasant voice to listen to. So I contacted her agent directly, which one doesn't usually do as an author, but I just wanted to see if she'd be interested. And yeah, in the end, my publisher loved her voice. So yeah, she's definitely got the Emma Makepeace voice in my mind.
I know Emma's not from the same background as you, but if you were to write an American character, do you think you would give it a go yourself?
No, I don't think so. I think narrating an audiobook is such a skill, and actors have all the training they need to make it really come alive. And I think writers can be too close to the source material. And it's lovely to get a complete outsider who's not been there the whole time you've been working on it to see it through their eyes, hear it through their words. I love that. I think it's such an important part of the process.
You listen to audiobooks yourself?
Oh my gosh, constantly. Yes, I'm kind of an audiobook addict. They're always on when I'm doing things in the house or driving in my car. I was thinking about how until until maybe, I guess, about 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, we had to listen to them on CDs. And it was trickier to get them, and they were usually abridged, and it was such a fumbly thing. And how wonderful it is now. They're the ultimate good thing that's come out of sort of streaming, and that we can just go from one book to another.
Also, it opens up the book to people who, for whatever reason, can't access print. Is that important to you? Your book's accessible for everyone?
Oh my gosh, yes, it's so important. I was telling a friend that when I lived in New Orleans, there was something, I don't know if it's the same here, it was the same in the 1990s, that's when I lived there. There was something called Radio for the Blind, and it was all day long, it was people reading the newspaper aloud and reading books aloud. I loved listening. I listened to that all the time. It was just this marvelous resource, but it was all volunteers. It was all funded by donations. And I think opening it up more so that there's so much more choice now than there was then. And that's just fantastic, because it opens art up to everybody, and who wouldn't want that?
Now, talking of other versions of your book, for instance, audio, there may be a chance that The Chase will be coming to TV.
Yes, I'm very excited about this. So the series has been optioned by a company called Ink Factory, which is owned by John le Carré's sons, and produced a series called The Night Manager a few years ago, which I highly recommend. They really get this world of espionage. They really understand Emma Makepeace. They're extremely talented. So I'm very excited. There's a writer attached who's putting together the first episodes of the series. But unfortunately, right now, there's a strike in America of actors and writers. And so everything's put on hold for the moment. But hopefully that will be resolved very soon, and things can get back on track. But I'm really excited about this.
Have you any idea who you would cast to play Emma?
Oh gosh, it's such a, you know, in my ideal world, if people remember the early episodes, like when it first appeared on television, Killing Eve, and it did have well-known people in it, but mostly character actors, and Jodie Comer became basically one of the two lead actresses in it. And I love the idea of somebody like that, somebody who, not her now, because now she's famous, but somebody new and incredibly talented, just grabbing it and running with it would just make me so happy.
Target approaching. From her position inside the imposing marble-clad bank lobby, Emma Makepeace cast a glance through the bulletproof glass of the front window to the traffic beyond. The tiny electronic receiver tucked inside her right ear had been crackling with updates for the last 15 minutes, as a young man made his way through the streets of London, unaware that his every movement was being observed.
The Chase, alias Emma, Book 1, is available now in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and The Traitor, as of yesterday, is available wherever you buy your books or audiobooks. And Ava, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robert.
And more from Ava at the end of today's show. Some new books in the Talking Books Library after this.
Hello, this is Karen Barkey, also known as Officer Karen from Scott Squad on TV. And I just want to send tons of best wishes and congratulations to everyone at RNIB Connect Radio on your 20th anniversary. I can't believe it. I had the great privilege and good fortune of being a reader for RNIB Connect back in the day, and I am so pleased and proud that the station has gone from strength to strength and continues to grow and provide such a brilliant service.
First this week, we've recently added the best-selling autobiography, Friends, Lovers and the Big Terrible Thing by Matthew Perry. It was donated to us by Headline.
Every house I've ever lived in had a view. That's the most important thing to me. When I was 5 years old, I was sent on a plane from Montreal, Canada, where I lived with my mom, to Los Angeles, California, where I would visit my dad. I was what is called an unaccompanied minor. At one point, that was the title of this book. It was typical to send kids on planes back then. Flying children alone at that age was just something people did. It wasn't right, but they did it. For maybe a millisecond, I thought it would be an exciting adventure, and then realized I was too young to be alone, and this was all completely terrifying. One of you guys come pick me up. I was 5. Is everybody crazy? The hundreds of thousands of dollars that particular choice cost me in therapy? May I get that back, please?
The beloved star of Friends takes us behind the scenes of the hit sitcom and his struggles with addiction in this candid and funny memoir that delivers a powerful message of hope and persistence. In an extraordinary story that only he could tell, Matthew Perry takes the readers onto the soundstage of the most successful sitcom of all time, while opening up about his private struggles with addiction. Candid, self-aware, and told with his trademark humour, Perry vividly details his lifelong battle with the disease and what fueled it, despite seemingly having it all. Friends, Lovers, and the Big Terrible Thing is an unforgettable memoir that shares the most intimate details of the love Perry lost, his darkest days, and his greatest friends. Unflinchingly honest, moving, and hilarious, this is the book fans have been waiting for.
You do get all sorts of perks when you're an unaccompanied minor on a plane, including a little sign around your neck that reads unaccompanied minor. Plus early boarding, kids-only lounges, snacks up the yin-yang, someone to escort you to the plane. Maybe it should have been amazing. Later, as a famous person, I got all those perks and more at airports, but every time it reminded me of that first flight, so I hated them. The flight attendants were supposed to look after me, but they were busy serving champagne and coach. That's what they did in the anything-goes 1970s. The two-drink maximum had recently been done away with, so that flight felt like 6 hours in Sodom and Gomorrah. The stench of alcohol was everywhere. The guy next to me must have had 10 old fashions. I stopped counting after a couple of hours. I couldn't imagine why any adult would want to drink the same drink over and over again. Ah, innocence. I pushed the little service button when I dared, which wasn't often. The flight attendants in their 1970s hot boots and short shorts would come by, ruffle my hair, and move on. I was terrified. I tried to read my highlights magazine, but every time the plane hit a bump in the air, I knew I was about to die. I had no one to tell me it was okay, no one to look at for reassurance. My feet didn't even reach the floor. I was too scared to recline that seat and take a nap, so I just stayed awake, waiting for the next bump, wondering over and over again what it would be like to fall 35,000 feet. I didn't fall, at least not literally. Eventually, the plane began its descent into the beautiful California evening. I could see the lights twinkling, streets splayed out like a giant sparkling magic carpet, wide swaths of dark. I now know where the hills, the city pulsing up towards me as I plastered my little face against the plane window, and I so vividly remember thinking that those lights and all that beauty meant I was about to have a parent.
Friends, Lovers, and the Big Terrible Thing by Matthew Perry is narrated by the author and runs for 8 hours 50 minutes.
For readers of fantasy fiction, we have Ink, Blood, Sister, Scribe by Emma Tortz, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
Esther couldn't get over the blue of the sunlit sky. It was a variated blue, almost white where it met the snowy horizon, but deepening as Esther's eye followed it upward, from robin's egg to cerulean, to a calm, luminous azure. Beneath it, the Antarctic ice was blindingly bright, and the scattered outbuildings Esther could see from her narrow dorm window drew stripes of indigo shadow on the white ruts of the road. Everything gleamed. It was 8 o'clock in the evening, and not discernibly darker than it had been at 8 o'clock that morning.
Excuse me.
Pearl said, and hip-checked Esther to one side so she could fit a piece of custom-cut cardboard in the window frame. Esther fell backward onto her unmade bed and propped herself on her elbows, watching Pearl lean over the tiny, cluttered desk to reach the glass. If you'd told me 2 weeks ago I'd block the sun as soon as it came up, I would have laughed you off the station, Esther said. Pearl ripped the tape with her teeth. Well, 2 weeks ago, you were sleeping through the night. Never say the doc did nothing for you. She applied the last strip and added, or me. Thank you, darkness, and thank you, Pearl, Esther said.
For generations, the Cataly family has guarded a collection of rare and dangerous books. Books that let a person walk through walls or borrow someone else's face. Books of magic. Now Joanna Cataly lives alone in the woods of Vermont, their library's sole protector, while her estranged older half-sister, Esther, moves between countries and jobs, constantly changing, never staying anywhere for longer than a year, desperate to avoid the dangerous magic that killed her own mother. She is currently working as an electrician on a research base in Antarctica where she's found love. Maybe, finally, she feels free. But when someone on base begins using magic, Esther realizes that she can't outrun her family's legacy. The long-separated sisters must work together to unravel the secrets their parents kept hidden, secrets that span centuries and continents, and even other libraries.
Though she had indeed been sleeping badly since the sun had reappeared after 6 months of winter, it was still somewhat dispiriting to watch the light and the distant mountains vanish, plunging her back into the realities of her cell-like room. The bed with its rumpled purple sheets lit by the baleful overhead bulb, the scuffed tile floors and the plywood desk piled high with scattered papers, most of them notes on the Mexican novel Esther was translating for fun. The novel itself was on top of her dresser, safely out of range of the collection of half-full water glasses leaving rings on the notebook paper. Pearl sat opposite Esther at the foot of the bed and said, "So, are you ready to face the unwashed masses?" In response, Esther threw an arm over her eyes and groaned. Esther and Pearl had spent the past winter as two of just 30 others holding down the small South Pole station. But November had ushered in the summer season, and over the past few days, small, roaring cargo planes had disgorged nearly 100 new people into the station's hallways. Now scientists and astronomers filled the dorms, the galley, the gym, the upper workrooms, strangers who ate all the late-night cookies and booted up long-sleeping computers and asked constant, anxious questions about what time of day the internet satellite went up. Esther had imagined she'd be happy to see all these new faces. She'd always been a natural extrovert, not the typical candidate to be locked away on the ice in a research station that much resembled her tiny rural high school. She'd lived in Minneapolis for the year before she'd come here to the Antarctic, and her friends there had reacted with honest horror when she'd told them she'd accepted a job at the pole station as an electrician for the winter season. Everybody knew someone who'd tried it, loathed it, and flown home early to escape the crushing isolation. But Esther hadn't been worried. She'd figured Antarctica couldn't be that much worse than the isolated, extreme conditions in which she had grown up. It'd be good money, it'd be an adventure, and most importantly, it would be completely inaccessible to most every other person on the planet.
Ink, Blood, Sister Scribe by Emma Torres is read by Saskia Marleveld and runs for 13 hours, 54 minutes.
A recent customer request is Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat by Giles Milton, which was kindly given to us by John Murray from the Hachette Publishing Group.
Cecil Clark viewed his caravan with the sort of affection that most men reserve for their wives. He polished it, tinkered with it, and buffed up its cream paintwork with generous quantities of Richfield Auto Wax. More than 14 feet in height, it stood taller than a London double-decker, and its low-slung chassis was a revolutionary piece of engineering. But the real joy of Cecil's creation was its luxurious interior. It came with lavatory, bedrooms, and an ensuite bathroom. It had hot and cold running water and its own home-built generating plant. It also had a well-stocked bar. Little wonder that Cecil referred to it as his Pullman of the road. He had built it in his workshop behind the family home in Bedford. At weekends, he would hook it to the family charabanc and take it on road trials, hurtling through the local country lanes while his wife, Dorothy, clutched the dashboard and their two sons, John and David, made mischief in the back.
Shortly after the outbreak of the Second World War, a country house called The Firs in Buckinghamshire was requisitioned by the War Office. Sentries were posted at the entrance gates, and barbed wire was strung around the perimeter fence. To local villagers, it looked like a prison camp, but the truth was far more sinister. This rambling Edwardian mansion had become home to an eccentric band of scientists, inventors, and blue stockings. Their task was to build devastatingly new weaponry which could be used against the Nazis. Led by the gung-ho Millis Jefferis, the men and women who worked at Churchill's toy shop, as it became known, devised many of the key weapons of the Second World War. Their prototype limpet mine made possible the cockleshell raid on Bordeaux Harbour. Churchill said that this one raid alone shortened the war by 6 months. Next, they pioneered the water bomb that closed the Rhine to German shipping. Although the team at Churchill's toy shop proved extraordinarily adept, they were not working alone. Other country houses were also requisitioned and handed over to the specialists. Some focused on developing new weapons. Some planned sabotage missions in occupied Europe. Some became training schools for agents. But all were working towards a common goal: the destruction of the Nazi war machine. Collectively, they were known as the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
The young lads yelped with delight when their father announced that he was taking the family off to North Wales. There were a few tense moments as they bid their farewells to Bedford. Cecil had added a new bedroom on the caravan's first floor, and the vehicle was now so tall that he had to stop at every bridge and check that they had the necessary clearance. Once they were out on the open road, obstacles such as bridges were quickly forgotten. He got rather blasé, and simply charged at every bridge he came to, fortunately without any real damage. The fact that young John and David were larking about on the roof of the caravan, getting a fine view of the countryside, did not seem to bother him one jot. Cecil Nobby Clark had set up his company Low Load, the Low Loading Trailer Company, in the late 1930s, with himself as principal designer and Mrs. Clark as company secretary. All Low Load's caravans came equipped with a unique suspension system that promised passengers a smoother ride than any other caravan on the road. It was a promise in which Clark took considerable pride, for he was the designer, the engineer, the architect, and the mechanic. Clark was portly and bespectacled, a lumbering, gentle giant with heavy bones and a mechanic's hands. Half boffin, half buffoon, he had more than a touch of the Professor Brainstorm about him. An enthusiastic smoker and fervent patriot, he was viewed by his neighbours with affection tinged with humour. The embodiment of an ideal, thought one, always in his own way striving after the betterment of society. In Cecil's case, the betterment of society meant building more comfortable caravans. Those Bedford neighbours would smile knowingly to one another as they watched Nobby buffing the paintwork of his beloved vehicles, unaware that he had the hands of a magician and the brains of a genius.
Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat by Giles Milton, is read by Jonathan Keeble and runs for 12 hours and 19 minutes.
For those readers who like historical fiction, Quercus have donated The Bookseller of Inverness by S.G. MacLean.
Ishbel MacLeod watched her boy, Tormod, scamper down the close past Bow Court and out onto the street. He was desperate to get out every day at this time to watch the children spill out from the school at Dunbar's Hospital.
Tormod spoke constantly of going to school and all he would do once he got there. Ishbel went after him, admonishing him to keep to the agreed streets, not to wander, and not to think of going down to the river, or up to the foul pool, or to the old burial ground of the Greyfriars. Tormod could not stay to listen. The school bell would be rung soon, the children released into the summer's evening. Ishbel looked up and down Church Street. There was nothing to alarm her, no unaccounted presence. The red-coated soldiers were going about their own business and taking no interest in the small boy. The inns and taverns were quiet as yet, the worst of them at outlying parts of the town in any case. Down the road a little, on the other side of the street, the door to the bookshop was still ajar. Tormod was rarely away from the place, oblivious, it seemed, to the bookseller's dark moods and forbidding demeanour. She knew the bookseller's habits almost as well as her own. The place would not shut until the tollbooth bell tolled six, and then the man himself would not emerge till eight, when he would lock the door carefully behind him. Those forced to remake their lives rarely deviated from the patterns by which they ordered their days. Ishbel knew this.
After Culloden, Ian McGilvery was left for dead on Drummossie Muir. Wounded, his face brutally slashed, he survived only by pretending to be dead as the redcoats patrolled the corpses of his Jacobite comrades. 6 years later, with the clan chiefs routed and the Highlands subsumed into the British state, Ian lives a quiet life, working as a bookseller in Inverness. One day, after helping several of his regular customers, he notices a stranger lurking in the upper gallery of his shop, poring over his collection. What the man refuses to say what he's searching for, and only leaves when Ian closes for the night. The next morning, Ian opens up the shop and finds the stranger dead, his throat cut, and the murder weapon laid out in front of him, a sword with a white cockade on its hilt, the emblem of the Jacobites. With no sign of the killer, Ian wonders whether the stranger discovered what he was looking for, and whether he paid for it with his life. He soon finds himself embroiled in a web of deceit and a series of old scores to be settled in the ashes of war.
She saw two women, Mrs. Rose and her daughter, go into the bookshop. They had not had to make their lives anew. They walked in the streets in freedom and good clothes. Ishbel was rarely out of her apron, tendrils of hair escaping from the linen wrap around her head, her pale face often flushed from the heat of the cookhouse, where she spent her days making her confections. The roses did not have burns on their hands and arms where they had been careless. Neither did they have tiny silver scars on their wrists, remarked by no one, where manacles had chafed, because they had not been able to run fast enough. Julia Rose was startled by what sounded like a murmur of amusement from the bookseller's desk. Turning her head as far as she dared, she risked a glance in that direction. Never before had she heard such a sound amongst the shelves and cabinets of this bookshop. It was rare, in fact, to hear any sound at all in here, save the sotto voce murmuring of customers, fearful of unnecessarily disturbing the man behind the desk, or the occasional furious Gallic outburst from the fellow who was said to work in the backroom bindery and whom she had never seen. "Julia!" her mother breathed, but the warning came too late. The bookseller had noticed her look at him. As he pushed back the curtain of pale blonde hair that swung habitually across the left side of his face, she saw the scarring. The right side was unmarked, a flawless reminder. But the left? She had never before seen it so clearly, hatched the full breadth of his cheek, and from the corner of his mouth upwards, stopping just short of his eye. For a moment she was frozen, could not turn away. But then some commotion from the upper gallery took his attention and released her from his gaze.
The Bookseller of Inverness by S.G. McLean is read by David Monteith and runs for 10 hours, 33 minutes. And now back to author Ava Glass with the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There are so many. I was an absolute obsessive reader as a child. I was voracious. And in fact, I have in my office an award I won when I was 11 for reading the most, checking out the most books from my school library in one school year and reading them and writing a report on each one. And I read 153 books. When I was 11 during the school year, so you can see. But when I say I was obsessive, I was. The book that I read multiple times and I still have a copy of, tattered and worn, is called Fog Magic by Julia Sauer. And it's a kind of Brigadoon story about a young girl who lives in modern times who is quite lonely. And on foggy days, when she walks down to the seaside, so to the coast from where she lives, the short journey to the beach, basically on the New England coast where she lives, the town that no longer exists there that she can, during on sunny days, see the remnants of, is back, and it exists and it's thriving. And there, it's the 19th century. There's a child who becomes her friend. It's just this amazing fantasy and a great way to discover the past for young people. And also, it deals with things like loneliness and friendship.
Greta was 10 when she began to sense that she was looking for something within the fog. Until then, it had only given her a happy feeling, just as the first snowflakes delighted some of the other girls and boys, or the first fall winds that set the birch leaves blowing. But from the day when she had gone alone to find old Rosie the cow, nothing had been quite the same.
Fog Magic by Julia L. Sauer is available commercially, as narrated by Jennifer Van Dyke. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
I think the book I've probably read the most over and over again is a book called The Secret History by Donna Tartt. It's the book that made me want to be an author when I first read it many years ago in the 1990s. It's set at a private New England university, very exclusive, and it follows a scholarship student who attends this university and sort of is dazzled by this world of beautiful, young, wealthy students who surround him. And yet he discovers that there is a dark heart to it. And it tells the story of a murder more or less in reverse. So the murder happens on the first page. And then the rest of the book sort of goes backwards, telling us how this occurred and how these people got so caught up in their own sort of turmoil and fantasies that they could commit this crime. And the thing that I love about it is that even though you know they're dangerous people who've done this terrible thing, by the end of the book, you still enjoyed spending time with them, which I know is hard to write. It's hard to make us care about people who've done a bad thing. I just think it's masterful.
Difficult to believe that Henry's modest plan could have worked so well despite these unforeseen events. We hadn't intended to hide the body where it couldn't be found. In fact, we hadn't hidden it at all, but had simply left it where it fell in hope that some luckless passerby would stumble over it before anyone even noticed he was missing. This was a tale that told itself simply and well.
The Secret History by Donna Tartt is available from R&IB Talking Books, as narrated by Adam Sims. It's also available commercially, as narrated by Donna Tartt. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
I have recently found myself reading older books. In particular, I've sort of fallen in love with the books of Agatha Christie, and in particular the audiobooks of Agatha Christie novels, which I have found funny and incredibly soothing in these troubled times. I've never read much Christie, so this has been a real exploration for me. And recently I read a book, or I listened to the audiobook of A Crooked House by Agatha Christie, which is just a wonderful, dark, tangled, but also sometimes funny tale about, again, this tells a story of a family where something's gone terribly wrong, a wealthy, sophisticated family where more than one person has been murdered in this house. And a young man who knows somebody in this family has been called in both as a friend of the family, and also he happens to be the son of a police officer. And he gradually begins to realize that something terrible has happened in this family, and that if he doesn't figure out who's doing this, that more people will die. And it's terribly dramatic in that way. And yet Christie had this remarkable ability to make that sort of a dark, twisted tale comforting. And I do not know how she does it. It boggles my mind. I cannot recommend these audiobooks highly enough. If you're looking for something a little soothing, but still with a great story, try The Crooked House.
Do you mind? I asked.
I shouldn't have minded a week ago. They're a well-established family. The girl will have money. And I know you. You don't lose your head easily. As it is, yes, dear, it may be all right if what? If the right person did it.
It was the second time that night I had heard that phrase. I began to be interested. Just who is the right person?
Crooked House by Agatha Christie is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library and commercially as narrated by Hugh Fraser. And Ava Glass, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute joy talking to you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. But remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.